When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Las Vegas. It's so much more than just a city.
It's a feeling. It's that feeling of excitement when you spot the lights of the strip out the airplane window.
It's that feeling of awe as you stroll down the boulevard, taking in the sights and sounds.
And it's that feeling of satisfaction, knowing that you're in the greatest city in the world.
Tens of millions of people share that feeling every year.
And I'm just one of them. Here to take you to the world-famous Vegas Strip
and beyond.
My name is Jeff, and this is Jeff Does Vegas. Welcome to episode number 178 of Jeff Does Vegas. Before we get into it for this episode of the podcast, I want to thank my guest from the last episode, Crystal Dahlstedt, Las Vegas promoter and the owner and creator of Vegas Free Guest Lists on Facebook and Instagram. For the last decade, Crystal has been helping Vegas visitors have amazing experiences during their time in the city, and she was kind enough to come on the show to have a discussion about pool parties and day clubs. We went in-depth on what to wear, how to act, what to bring, and what to expect cost-wise if you're planning on going poolside in Vegas this summer. If you haven't listened as of yet, you can jump into the archives at jeffdoesvegas.com or search out episode number 177, Neon Waves, an inside look at Las Vegas pool parties and day clubs. It's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you listen to podcasts. Something you may have noticed when traveling, specifically when you travel to Las Vegas, is that people behave in very different ways on vacation than they do when they're at home. That might mean drinking more and eating less healthy, taking risks you might not otherwise take, or straight up dropping all your inhibitions and becoming a totally different person. But why is that? Joining me to answer that question and many more is Dr. Michael Bryan, aka the Travel Psychologist. Michael is an author, lecturer, adventurer, and publisher of numerous travel books and guides. Michael and I went in-depth on the reasoning behind people's changes in behavior and attitude when they're on vacation, the types of personalities people adopt when they travel, and whether or not it's healthy for people to blow off steam when they're away from home. We also discussed what's behind recent reports of bad behavior by tourists and the role that both social media and past COVID lockdowns and restrictions have played in causing that behavior. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Michael Bryan, aka the Travel Psychologist.
I was a kind of a geeky, lanky, skinny, nerdy high school student excelling in science, and I was on my way to become a chemical engineer, if you will. And I went 1 year to Carnegie Mellon and quit after a year, deciding just because you did well in these subjects in high school doesn't mean you're ready to devote your whole life to it. And so I realized you really have to be totally in to do those subjects. So I transferred back after 1 year out of Carnegie Tech at the time in Pittsburgh and went back to Philly where I grew up, and started in with psychology courses and really got interested in that and thought, well, I'd rather pursue a career in this than in the, you know, engineering. And so I went through a BA and an MA in psychology. And my last year, just before I graduated, with the MA from Temple University. I went overseas with a couple of friends, and the travel bug bit me in the rear end. And then I came back that summer, and I thought to myself, do I want to be a clinical psychologist dealing with mental illness the rest of my life? And I thought, I don't think I want to do that. So lo and behold, I was offered a full fellowship if I stayed at Temple University to do the PhD in clinical psychology. And I thought, I think I'm going to go to the University of Hawaii. And my parents could have wrung my neck, because there I was throwing away something that was very good and going to a strictly unknown environment, although I knew that I'd probably enjoy going to graduate school in Hawaii. But at the same time, for the same token, I saw that there was a professor in the psychology department who was working in the visitor industry in Hawaii. And I knew tourism was huge in Hawaii. So I thought, I'm going to study the psychology of travel. And nobody had ever really done that. So I went out in 1965 and got myself a job with the Hawaii Visitors Bureau, looking at surveys and why people came to Hawaii and so on and so forth. And I loved every minute of it. And now it was time to face a big round table full of staid-looking, serious faculty members at the University of Hawaii, meeting each of the new graduate students one-on-one around the big round table. And I was in there, sitting there, and I'll tell you, I was scared. It was scary. But I was a good student. I was accomplished. So two guys immediately from that table asked me, well, why are you here? What do you want to study? Fair enough. I said, I'm here to study the psychology of travel. And you could have heard a pin drop. And one of these two attacked me verbally. Mm-hmm. He was what they call a rat psychologist or an animal behaviorist. Maybe not interested in people all that much, and maybe not getting along with them all that well. So they said to me, this one said to me, you can't study that here. There's no such subject as the psychology of travel. Look what I gave up. All right, so what did I do? I might have stood up and I might have pointed at that one. Who are you to define what this field is all about? If that's your attitude, I don't think I want to be here. And stupid me stood up, walked out the door, and headed towards the exit of the building. And then I heard pitter-pattering of footsteps behind me. Two other faculty members stopped me, a hand on his shoulder. Stop right there. Just because they said that doesn't mean the rest of us agree with them. Get yourself back into that room. And I did. And for the next 5 years, I had nothing to do with those two guys that attacked me. And I became the first travel psychologist. Oh, I did the doctorate in social psychology. But there were interesting sidelines to this whole thing. The University of Hawaii had a contract with the Peace Corps to train people for overseas service. And I got hired to do that. I loved every minute of it. And they let me take the language course. I was also a language buff. I took 2 years of intensive Mandarin Chinese one summer. I took 2 years of Indonesian one summer at the University of Hawaii. It packed in a whole year in each of the two summer sessions. And I learned to speak somewhat the Tongan language, Tonga, like Samoa, one of the Pacific Island kingdoms. And I learned that language, and I was good, and it was fun. And I was a teacher's pet, and would have beers with them when they came to Honolulu so on and so forth. So lo and behold, I finished my PhD. I did an interesting study on spatial behavior and nonverbal communication subjects and culture shock, say, of a Peace Corps volunteer going and living in a totally different culture than where he or she grew up in, and dealing with the low point that a person might get trying to understand and communicate with people in depth in the culture, but not having the language skills or the nonverbal skills to interact with people all that well. And I, well, that's culture shock. That's really interesting. And then, you know, I completed the PhD in social psychology, but I studied for my dissertation the human use of space. And then I learned and realized that's not always the same with people around the world. Your any kind of communication that you do, verbal or nonverbal, can be affected by the cultures that you're going to, and so on and so forth. And then I began to think, how am I going to learn about the psychology of travel if I'm the first one that ever really looked at this? And I got the interesting idea in my mind, well, why don't I just ask people? And then I know it sounds funny, but it's really the truth.
Yeah.
And then I began the systematic study of interviewing around 2,000 travelers over the next four decades, wherever I went. I went to shows put on by friends of mine called Body, Mind, Spirit Expos, and people would come up and sit down with me, and I'd record their stories. And I thought, why don't I ask people about the good, wonderful, terrific, fantastic, out of this world, bad, horrible, close calls, dangerous situations, stupid things that they've done, and I've done. And lo and behold, I recorded approximately 2,000 interviews. I used a program called Otter.ai. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but it allows you to transcribe tapes and MP3 files phenomenally well, and I have search programs. So here I am with thousands of stories, putting them together and developing kind of a working knowledge of the psychology of travel as told by people in dealing with their situations. And I had a lot of fun with that. For example, somebody would tell me how they just got pickpocketed and lost everything. And then I say, okay, let's take a look at that again. Let's go back. What would you have done differently? So I find, looking back, I'm asking some of the same questions these days as I asked people 40 years ago when I was asking them about their stories. So that's how this developed. And I've had some commercial applications of my knowledge base in this, but largely I've been writing books on the subject and doing a fair number of podcasts and really enjoying it.
You mentioned that it was the travel bug, or you were kind of bit by the travel bug. Was that really what, when you were traveling and sort of observing people's behavior and seeing what was going on when they were traveling, was that really what led you to say, you know what, I think this would be interesting to study the psychology side of this thing and the behavior of people?
It's a bit of both. But I also use myself as a lab rat, going back to these animal behaviorists. I taught for 2 years in Europe with the University of Maryland to American service people and sometimes their dependents and sometimes local people living in these countries. For 2 years, I traveled around my Volkswagen bus and got myself into all kinds of interesting personal situations. And here I was, I'd be interviewing people and collecting these stories and thinking about it and undoubtedly forming a kind of a knowledge base from all of the above.
So, I mean, how would you define travel psychology then? What would be your definition of travel psychology?
Well, that is a really good question. And I think it's probably still evolving in my own mind to my way of thinking. But I think it's the looking at and studying and talking about and exploring the stories as people have told me what they're experiencing. And then the questions that I formulated in my mind that came out of these things. For example, I was just working on today a new book that I'm writing, which again is based on the stories that people tell me and my asking them questions about their experiences to get them to elaborate and explore their feelings, their thoughts, their emotions, their reactions, and how, if they were to relive the situation over again, how they might do things differently. And I'm just all along, I'm trying to understand. And sometimes I hit fantastic gems. I'll give you one really interesting example. The current book I'm writing on, again, it's a gathering of stories. It's about conveyance from cars to camels. The title of the book will be Travel Tales, Driving Abroad from Cars to Camels. And I started talking to people about camel riding. And there is a series of stories, the scam, famous scam that takes place at the Egyptian pyramids. I don't know if it's still going on today, but what happened was you paid to get on the camel, and unbeknownst to you, you were asked to pay to get off the camel. Now the camel's about 7 feet high. Well, I had this one woman talking about how terrified she was to sit on top of this camel that was 7 feet above the ground. And she thought, if I fall off this camel, I'm dead. I'm a dead woman. And it turns out that, and I would not normally know this, it's just that I'm exploring these things. And suddenly she had an epiphany. Suddenly she got over the fear by having the simple attitude, well, I'm going to go with this, and I'm just going to be in the situation, and I'm just not going to worry about it, and I'm going to see what happens. And she overcomes her fear. It's gone. The same woman was waiting for a train around midnight one night that it didn't come till like 4:30 in the morning. And she said she observed rats, monkeys, dogs, cows, all running around the tracks and the station. She was terrified. She thought, I might get bitten by one of these things, or the monkey might steal my banana from me. And I mean, she was really scared. And then suddenly the same lady gets this epiphany and she realizes, wait a minute, if I just be with this situation and not be anxious, not be fearful, and just accept it for what it is and see what happens, and then she turns the whole situation around. Now, I would not have normally looked at something like this and thought about this, but the sum total is I'm overwhelmed by the things people have told me. And so much of it is psychological in nature. So that's travel psychology.
I wanted to reach out to you to talk about people's behavior on when they travel and on vacation. And specifically with a place like Las Vegas, it's this magical, wonderful world where, of course, the slogan for the longest time was what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. And it really seems like a place like Vegas, they really take that to heart in a big way. What is it that makes people behave differently when they're on vacation? I mean, it seems like people really do become entirely different people when they travel.
And that's something I've been looking at a lot because I've noticed that as well. We all see that. Another name for it could be the spring break phenomena. You know, where people just go wild during spring break. You know, most people aren't doing bad, dangerous, horrible things, but they're extending their boundaries. Because one of the things I realized there early on is I began to relook at the so-called needs pyramid, Abraham Maslow. We've all had that in our psychology one or 101 textbooks in college about the idea that we have some basic needs that we need to basically take care of first. And then we have higher order needs up the pyramid. So safety and security is very fundamental. Love and belonging and achievement. And ultimately at the top, and we all see examples, be all that you can be. So when you take care of these basic needs of survival, you have time, you have room to explore and expand and try to become all that you can be. We see a great example of that in skiers and mountain climbers and people going to Everest and climbing to the tops of mountains. They're all trying to elevate themselves, so to speak, to higher states of satisfaction. It's human need satisfaction. And to my way of thinking and discovering from all this interviewing, there is no faster way to go through and try to reach the top of this needs pyramid than through traveling. Why? Because we're open to novelty. When we're open to novelty, we're open to more and more possibilities for ourselves. And I think we learn very quickly as we morph from tourists who are very superficially involved in the cultures to adventurers and travelers who realize that we feel so much better getting the rewards of trying out new things, and we're open to the novelty. In fact, we're seeking the novelty. Why? Because we certainly begin to feel much better about ourselves. The more rewards and successes we have, the more we want to repeat that. And I'm saying for most travelers, this is the natural progression that we take. What else are we seeking? We're seeking to connect with people too and travel with other travelers, other people. The locals that we meet are more open to the interactions that we have. And again, for every positive, successful interaction, we feel a personal reward. We feel a little more personal growth. And I like to think of that also in terms of what I call the Western walkabout. And it sounds a little funny and a little cute, but I think it's true. We learned early on that young adults, young Native Australian adults, Aboriginal peoples typically sent their kids out on their own to grow a little bit. How? By traveling, surviving, and being rewarded and maturing and growing. And I think a lot of our parents, unbeknownst to us, here, Johnny, go have a summer abroad. Go take a year abroad. And secretly having the inside knowledge that they're going to come back a little more mature, a little more world savvy. And for the most part, all the crazy things we're going to do, you know, are pretty safe and pretty secure. But we're learning from things like having been pickpocketed once. That's all it takes. We learn more, we expand, we grow, we like the rewards. There's no quicker way to personally grow than through travel, as far as what I think I've learned.
People seem to really, they let loose when they go on vacation as well, whether it's they're eating differently or drinking more or engaging in behaviors that maybe aren't behaviors they would normally engage in. Why do people act like that? Is it, do they think they can get away with it because they're in a strange place? Is it just sort of people are out of their routine and they're sort of off their guard? What's the reasoning behind that?
The controls are gone. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're living back in our mundane, normal lives, me too, all of us, we dumb ourselves down. Why? We want everything to be predictable. We don't have to think about what we're going to do every moment of what we're doing it. And we're in that routine where we become less conscious of everything around us. It's all regular, predictable, safe and secure, and in a sense, we're dumbed down. Now, when you suddenly remove those shackles and you're in an environment of freedom, it's no wonder that some people go wild to some extent. Now, I'm always saying most people are basically well-behaved or maybe a little mischievous. I like to think of while we're traveling, we may have a group of I have a term for this. What do I call it? Archetypes. So, Joker. It's fun to try out things and get laughs and do all this stuff. We're the Joker. We are predominantly the actor. We take on different roles and we experiment with it. And then we're suddenly surprised. Oh my God, I've got a roof over my head. Oh, I can order a meal at the restaurant. And we feel better about ourselves. So we're able to take some more risks. And again, I call us silly, stupid scoundrels, crazy, stupid scoundrels for some of the funny things, situations we get ourselves into. And I've done my share personally. Nothing too serious. But sometimes it does get a little out of hand. See examples of bad behavior on airplanes. And I began to think about that. I wondered, was it something about travel that made people engage in bad behavior, particularly, especially like on airplanes? And I began to think of more of it as being a consequence of, say, COVID than not that. And why did I think that? Because I, again, in my studies of nonverbal communication and interaction between peoples, knowing that spatial differences exist culturally, nationally, and individual differences between people, and COVID increased that. Mm-hmm. We all have the tendency to touch, shake hands, fist bump, hug. We all have different degrees of this emotional expression, verbal and nonverbal, touching, eye contact, facial expressions, all covered with masks. Suddenly, maybe we weren't conscious of it, but we were feeling the interpersonal distance. And I think some examples of people doing bad things on airplanes were adverse reactions to people losing all these cues, losing the emotional connection with people, being more distanced, maybe even being a little angry, and not really understanding that COVID did this to people. COVID increased the distances between people. So I think that accounts for some of the bad behavior. And it could account for some of the bad behavior overseas if we feel more distant from people. Then we're capable, at least, of having more unpleasant interactions with people. I think this is more the exception than the rule, but I think it helps to explain, for example, why people misbehave on airplanes to some extent. And you know, the more impersonal the interactions are with people, for example, overcrowding at tourist sites, the more negativity and distancing people are feeling, and maybe not even consciously always aware of it, but that can engender some negative interactions between people.
You mentioned the archetypes, and I wanted to touch on that a little bit more because I found that concept fascinating because I feel we all kind of fall into those archetypes when we travel to a certain degree. What do you think it is that makes people pick their travel personality? Is it an extension of their actual personality, or is it a case of, ooh, I think I just like to do something a little bit different and maybe be a slightly different person? What is it that makes people pick that their travel personality?
It's probably to some extent a natural progression a bit from where they've been in their lives and maybe being a little more experimental about their lives. So I was always a frustrated actor. One time, I'll give you an example, I was in junior high school. I wanted to see if I could get the lead part in a play. Now, what was I, 11? I don't remember how old I was. But I tried out for the part, and I got it. I got the part, and then went home and told my mother and father. And the next day I came back, told the teacher, oh, you know, I just found out we're moving away from the neighborhood, and I can't really do that part in your play. I think I knew that all the time. I just wanted to see if I could do it, but I liked the idea. So we may take these things about ourselves and feel a sense of freedom, freedom to experiment a little bit, and that might be the direction we might go with it. Or we could stumble into it accidentally. But I think it's probably our interests and our upbringing and some of these things that are coming to express themselves a little bit. You know, hidden interests and thoughts and desires that make their way out as you get more experience with life.
Is it healthy? I mean, aside from, you know, any obvious danger that somebody might put themselves into by behaving differently or acting out of the ordinary, is this blowing off steam and letting loose while you're on vacation? Is this something that humans need to do? I mean, obviously we can't keep everything all bottled up all the time. When we go away, is it healthy for us to just sort of do this?
You know, I mean, that's an excellent question. I'm not really sure, but I think for most of us, we're not going to get ourselves in trouble and do things. I remember this story about these two American servicemen finishing up their tour in England. And what do? They decided to rabble rouse, and they poured bubble bath in the Trafalgar Fountain in London's Trafalgar Square. And of course, it was all over the world. I don't know if the internet exists. Let's catch these guys. Let's give them toothbrushes and ask them to clean up Trafalgar Square with a toothbrush. They want to put bubble baths in our fountain. And of course, these guys were coming home to the United States, and the nephew of one of them heard it on the Paul Harvey, the rest of the story, famous news broadcast about these American guys that poured bubble bath in the Trafalgar Fountain, and they should be caught and prosecuted and so on and so forth. And the nephew knew his uncle was coming back, and he just wanted to ask him, did you hear these guys who did this? And the father was an ex-policeman, and he's standing there listening to his son, and the son turns white as a sheet. You mustn't tell anybody that I did this. That's an extreme example. We all want to let off a little steam. You know, the spring break is largely a society's way of saying, all right, you have the freedom to go to your normal self. And mostly it's harmless. It's not always the case. It's a matter of degree. And, you know, people have to be careful they don't overdo things. Obviously.
Yeah. I mean, I see it when I've traveled to Vegas and, you know, you go to a pool party or any of the public events and it's bedlam a lot of times. And you can tell the people that are there who are maybe a little buttoned up on a normal basis, right, who are there and are obviously having a blast, but they are letting loose way more than any other human being normally would.
Yeah, and mostly it's harmless, but sometimes, like bad behavior on an airplane, it can happen. And let's face it, we have to be careful and cautious about this. And some of us, more seasoned travelers than others, might be traveling with friends who see a little bit more of an exaggeration than maybe is normal and healthy for them to be like. And that's where our advice and suggestions are important and helpful in a situation like that. For the most part, it doesn't get too out of hand, but it can. There's no question about it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Something else that I did want to talk to you about was, in general, just bad tourist behavior. I'm a not just a Vegas traveler, but a pretty frequent traveler around the world and various places. And I've seen, more so since we kind of hit on it a little bit talking about COVID and how that sort of changed the travel habits of people. But I mean, even pre-COVID, I saw a lot of stuff. But what is it about traveling and vacation that really can just make people behave like absolute idiots? I mean, there's bad manners, there's disrespecting locals, ignoring rules and signs, and disrespecting monuments, and bad attitude towards other tourists. I mean, what is it that really causes that? Do we know? Do we have any idea?
Well, I think I've come across some of it, and I don't necessarily have pat explanations for them, but I've seen what you're talking about, and often, like at sports venues, people can go crazy and toss cushions into arenas and get out of hand, and the loss of personal control, the fact that there aren't other people who know you. Nobody's going to report back on you. You have greater anonymity, and the more anonymity you have, the more possible it is to misbehave. And we need to do, as residents of countries where a lot of tourists come in, we need to do what we can to rein it in to some extent. And an interesting example is what Venice in Italy is doing now. They're vastly reducing the number of people that are coming into San Marco Square, and, you know, mostly where those canals are. And I see other examples of that in different places. I've seen museums, famous points of interest, now having timed tickets to regulate the flow of people through the area. Same thing, Mount Everest, believe it or not, regulating the flow of visitors and hikers up to Everest, because the more abuse of the situation, the more negativity and distancing of people from one another takes place. And the more you distance yourself from other people, locals and other visitors, the more you can express your frustration of the situation in the form of negative behavior and negative acts. So I think the overcrowding and lack of regulating burgeoning tourist areas, if we don't do something to regulate the density and the interaction, unpleasant interpersonal interactions between peoples, the more negativity and bad experiences, bad behavior we're going to see. I think a lot of it is out of frustration, more so than, say, the feeling of personal freedom and anonymity. I think there's all these factors at play. And I think you and I are coming up with examples of situations where we can see the negativity, feel that negativity increasing by the over-density of people in close interaction, but yet interpersonally distant from one another. And so that fosters anger, that fosters bad behavior. And I think that's happening along with some of the good things that are happening to us in travel. And it's a growing phenomena. And I think you're seeing it in Vegas. I wonder if it has something to do with the tons of people coming to Vegas and losing money, and they're losing resources. And if that doesn't build up to some of the frustration that they may feel, tell me if that's something that you have observed. I mean, you don't know. I mean, they say that the majority of people are going to lose money. I mean, that's how it works, right?
Those bright lights aren't lit by winners. So,
yeah.
Vegas is not built on winners.
I don't know that the psychology of travel can explain everything we're observing with travelers, but that bad tourism, examples of badly behaved people, is certainly growing and needs to be mitigated more and more.
What role do you think social media has played in this? I know from, my own experience, a story I like to tell from a few years ago of traveling to New York City. And it was my first time ever going to New York and going to the 9/11 memorial, the fountains. And when my wife and I first got there, we went first thing in the morning and it was very serene and quiet. And we went through the museum and the memorial. And by the time we came out 3 or 3.5 hours later, it was jammed and it was busy. And I was working in news media at the time of 9/11. So I would, for me to go there was a big deal. And I felt walking around and seeing people doing selfies and taking pictures, I was really quite bothered by that. It felt really inappropriate to me. And I know I've seen other Facebook pages of people behaving inappropriately like that and other places where it feels inappropriate, going to, concentration camps in Poland and Germany and taking selfies and behaving inappropriately. What role do you think social media has played in creating that bad behavior? Because it does seem like people they're trying to get that perfect Instagram photo, or they're trying to get that perfect TikTok video. Is this, clearly it is an issue.
On the one hand, the internationalization of social media has even the balance a little bit, and people can relate to one another a little more because of a sort of an overlaying of an international media effect. And that's a good, that's positive. But the extent of which international media, internet media, becomes anonymous and devoid of controls, where again, you can be selfish in the sense that you don't know that the other people are seeing your behavior as not very good, it's tasteless. There are certainly cultural differences that a lot of Americans, for example, are not that aware of. Case in point is a friend of mine who in the 60s was wearing mini skirts and goes into these temples in Thailand, and the guards say, "No, you can't come in here. You are too tall for your dress," and stuff like
that.
That's
a nice way of saying it.
She got snuck in another entrance, and she got to see it. But, you know, she was oblivious to the different cultural views of dress. And the more crazy and weird foreign media, TikTok stuff is, the more people emulate it and think it's okay. But what they don't realize is that they're going to be perceived differently to some extent in these cultures, and probably largely by the older people who are not internet savvy. And they're probably going to younger people, not so much. You know, there's sort of a median that everybody approaches international. So it's good and it's bad. And I agree with you that there is this effect, and we don't know where it's going to go. We don't know where AI is going to take us. I hate to think of us as being this selfish, that because of social media, where there doesn't seem to be any regulation and stuff is ugly and bad, but it's the attitudes about it change, and they don't feel as bad. They don't feel they're being perceived as bad. But the selfie thing was one of the earlier expressions of just lack of awareness of your actions on local people and other people. And the selfie was one of the early things that people were talking about. It used to be people walked around in Hawaiian shirts, straw hats, white sneakers, shorts, big bellies, and Aloha shirts and cameras. And we used to think, yeah, you know, they're just going to see life through their cameras. Well, now they're seeing life through their iPhones to some extent. And I used to joke, I used to say, you know, we can't wait till we get to Paris. I couldn't wait till I could sit in a coffee house, even if it was a Starbucks, and maybe talk to a Parisian. In one case, I was talking to two Japanese tourists that were sitting the next table. And then I suddenly discovered that everyone, including the Parisians, were staring at their cell phones.
I remember taking a picture one time walking up Las Vegas Boulevard right in front of the Mirage of the Volcano Show. And I was across the street and I snapped this picture, and it was the volcanoes going off, and it's just all these people, and all you could see was little white dots of phones. And it was everybody holding up their cell phone, taking video of the volcano, video that they will probably watch once and never watch again. But they're taking that video rather than actually living in reality, in the actual moment of what they're seeing.
And for the Hawaiian shirted guy with the camera, it's not any different than that. It's just a different expression of it. And it's part of the reality that we live in. And it's not totally surprising, but there is an internationalization. So I think that age, that the older people get, the more disturbed they're going to feel about what they're seeing. And the younger ones are forming a happy median. And you know, that's probably how it's going to go.
I'm definitely falling into that older audience. I, without without shame, I will admit I have told kids to literally get off my lawn.
Oh.
So I'm falling right in there. So I'm starting to feel that. We hit a little bit on earlier as well on the role that COVID and the lockdowns and travel restrictions played on some of this bad behavior. I mean, I'm in Canada, so we had very restrictive lockdowns and border restrictions and travel restrictions, and it took a long time before we were able to travel again. Was it kind of a case of, I mean, did people that much sort of time locked away, did we just kind of forget how to socialize and behave properly around other people? I mean, yes, there were all of these, there was people behaving poorly on airplanes and in public before COVID, but it certainly seems like it has gotten a lot worse since people started coming out of their bubbles.
I think so, because I personally feel that people got distanced from one another more and didn't realize, really didn't think about it, didn't understand it, reacted negatively, reacted badly to it. It's just not something a lot of people realize, the nonverbal aspects of interrelating with other people. And I stumbled onto this in my studies and my interviewing and formulated that kind of thinking, that if you're less conscious and less aware of it, you're more capable of abusing it. It's when you become more aware of your interactions with other people that you learn to modify your behavior. So a lot of it was relatively due to unawareness of what was going on between us and other people. I do agree with that, and I think that's part of it.
Do you think people became maybe a little bit more self-involved or a little bit more selfish as well, or just not so aware of the people around them? And I find this is the kind of behavior that drives me crazy when I'm out just in public in general, but when I'm in Vegas, where people are just sort of la 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 in their own little world, totally oblivious to what's going on around them. And there was a bit of that pre-COVID, but it certainly seemed to get a lot worse after.
Yeah. It's part of the difference that I think of in terms of being a tourist versus a traveler versus an adventurer. And that is a continuum of the more experience that you have interacting with people in the different cultures, and the more you venture out from yourself and make connections with people, the more you learn how to be a traveler rather than a tourist. Tourist is withdrawn, sticks with the group travel more than anything else, and feels alienated from the people because they don't, number one, necessarily perceive it until they're into it more and seeing the differences of how they are as they become more experienced travelers and look back. And it is a learning mechanism that helps you become more of an international citizen. This is why I think the psychology of travel is really important. If we're going to understand and interrelate with and interact with people all over the world, we have to expand our awareness in ways that we just didn't have the paradigms to think that way. When you live your life as you live back home and don't give it a second thought to the deeper meaning that you get when you make closer, better understood connections with other people, the more the consequences can be negative. And a great example of that is the hordes of pickpocketers that are waiting for Americans and Canadians to get off the planes and onto the trains and into the streets of Europe, where they're just operating on not all cylinders functioning, and they have not even the remotest thought that they could get pickpocketed, because they're just not attending to the present, but rather living on the way they do at home, bringing their cultural, social, cultural matrix of puzzle pieces all together in American culture, Canadian culture, and not realizing that the pieces don't fit exactly the same way. And we're half asleep and half unconscious. I'm just using this as an exaggeration, but I can't tell you how many pickpocketing stories I have recorded because people were not expanding their awareness in the new culture and just living on their predictable, blind way of going about their lives back home. And that's how they get pickpocketed, get themselves into some dangerous situations that they shouldn't be in.
This has been a fascinating conversation. I love it. I absolutely love it. If people want to learn a little bit more about travel psychology and learn more about you and pick up one of your many books, you've got a ton of books covering a ton of different topics, not just travel psychology, but some other great topics as well. if people want to do that, how can they go about doing that? You are, of course, online. You have a website.
Yes, I have a website, which is good. You peek at some different travel psychology subjects, and that's michaelbryan.com. I invite you to look at that, and I'll tell you, as strange as it may seem, there's not a lot of people out there studying the psychology of travel, and I think it's a very valid, legitimate subject, and one day, maybe, I think people will take more notice of the work I'm doing, and there's some other people that are starting to venture into this. So thanks for asking. I think you'll be entertained and informed and have a few laughs too.
And that wraps up another episode of Jeff Does Vegas. If you've got feedback on this episode of the show, or any other episode for that matter, or you've got suggestions and ideas for topics you'd like me to cover on the podcast, please feel free to reach out via social media on Facebook, X, or Instagram at Jeff Does Vegas. You can also email me directly at jeff@jeffdoesvegas.com. In the meantime, thanks for checking out the show. Be sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts so you'll be notified the instant a new episode is released. While you're there, go ahead and rate us and write a review. And don't forget to visit jeffdoesvegas.com for past episodes, show notes, Vegas deals, and more. My name is Jeff, and this has been Jeff Does Vegas, a Walker New Media production.
Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.